All right. Well, thanks. It's good to be here. So, as I was just explaining, this is a picture of something that might be a type 1A supernova. You've got a white dwarf up in the... Is there a pointer or something here? All right. There we go. Well, I think one will be just fine. So, right. So this is something that is probably going to become, well, the leading theory, at least, is that something like this is what happens. You have a white dwarf up here, an accretion disk, and it accretes matter from an evolved star that overfills its Roche lobe. And now, when I was younger, I used to be on a basketball team called the Roche Lobe Trotters. And this was before I even knew that I was like an undergrad, and I didn't even know I was going to do supernovae, much less cosmology. And somehow we ended up putting, like, Einstein on the shirt. And so, I don't know, somehow it has to do with both 1As and cosmology. So, here we go. All right, so anyway, just, I know you've had talks about this stuff before, so I just wanted to do the summary in like 1 minute. So, of cosmology and type 1As. Well, at first, you start with Aristotle. People thought that the heavens were perfect and it was filled with ether. But then Tycho Brahe said, no, wait, there's a new star, and it happens to be a type 1A. And so, actually, the heavens aren't quite so unchanging. Then, today this is what Tycho's remnant looks like. Here's what his other remnant looks like. Then Copernicus, of course, introduced a coordinate transformation that was really famous. Then you get to these guys, skipping over a few people. But basically, Michelson gets the prize for saying, actually, there isn't any ether. Einstein says, well, there's relativity and all of that kinds of stuff. Gets his own, these guys say, confirmed it and so on. There are no slouches. Then he gets a Nobel Prize. Okay. Then he says the solutions are unstable, so maybe we need a cosmological constant. Edwin Hubble discovers that actually there's a whole rest of the universe out there, and it's expanding. The janitor concurs. So I don't know if you know this story about Humeson. He was really dropped out of school at 14, became the janitor, then became the night assistant, and then co-discovered expansion of the universe with Hubble. It's really cool. Anyway, he said, oops, actually, I don't need the cosmological constant. Then Walter Adams discovers white dwarf stars, which is awesome. And then, Zwicky says, they're called supernovae, they're stark matter, and you're all spherical bastards. Saul says, hey, we can use these exploding white dwarfs to probe the expansion of the universe. Brian Schmidt says, good idea, I'll beat you to it. Then there's a big supernova fight, which is still going on. And then people said, the universe is accelerating, we need dark energy after all. Then there's a whole bunch of prize, like $2.5 million worth, and then now SNLS. So this brings us up to 2003, and then I'll take it from here about what we're doing. Okay, so we've got this survey, which is the Supernova Legacy Survey. So it's designed to see what is this dark energy. It's groups in Toronto. So there's four of us there, three postdocs and Ray Carlberg. In Victoria, Chris Pritchett and Dave Balam, up until recently, had been discovering our supernovae. And then over in Paris and the UK, there is our French group, which does everything independently up, and Mark Sullivan, who came from Toronto and is now over there. Okay, so the French group does everything completely independent of ours, but they more care about the cosmology, so then we compare notes on the cosmology. But when it comes to the other transient science, it's more just us. And everything I'm going to say today is basically the Toronto analysis. But it does involve especially the work of Kathy Parrott, Mark Sullivan, and Alex Conley, and me. Okay, so, you've all seen this kind of thing before. The universe is mostly dark energy and dark matter. We don't know what it is. Is this stuff a property of the vacuum, a scalar field? Does it change with time? We're really at the level of not knowing much of anything. So, of course, what do you want to do? You want to measure the equation of state. How does the pressure change with changing density? Okay, so to do that, we can just take a look at the Friedman equation, and the components of the universe, as we know them, are, you've got matter that dilutes as the cube, so it's like normal stuff. You put something in a box, you increase the size of the box, and it dilutes like stuff normally does. Radiation gets an extra power. Curvature is probably zero. I'll show that, so that doesn't matter. Dark energy is the thing that we want to solve for then by making this Hubble diagram. So, there's a couple of ways of looking at that. If W is less than minus 1, you know, you put a minus 1 in here, less than minus 1, you get something positive here. So as the universe gets bigger, the scale factor increases, you get this runaway dark energy. So you get what, here's just an artist's conception of what's called, you know, the big rip. You may or may not believe the physics of this, but this is what it says should happen. Eventually, the universe will be ripped apart. Galaxies will be ripped apart, and even little things. Okay. Or the universe, it could be W is minus 1, so that's, you know, like Einstein. Again, it could be that just, well, he was right after all. Okay. Or it could be quintessence. Okay, quintessence is a scalar field that can evolve. So the name comes from, well, Plato had fire, earth, air, and water. As I mentioned earlier, Aristotle added ether. And quintessence comes from quintessentia, the fifth element. So in other words, it's a Bruce Willis-like substance whose power decreases with time. Okay, so like, here's his box office earnings over the last few years, and Bruce Willis tracker model. Okay, so it's as astrophysically motivated as any quintessence model. But all right, anyway. I'm not really biased. We want to actually test this for real. So what do? You need to just get standard candles and look back and make a map of the expansion history of the universe. Supernovae make a great one of those because they're comparable in brightness to their host galaxy, and you can see them very far back in the universe, and they're fairly standard. Okay, so just to recap again, these types of supernovae are not what most people think of when they think of supernovae. That's core collapse supernovae, which are something like an 8 solar mass star or bright or larger, that when it collapses it leaves a neutron star or a black hole. Now, what does this have to do with Shaquille O'Neal, you might ask? At 7'1", 325 pounds, and at 36 years old, he was recently traded to the Suns, which makes him an aging supergiant center of the Suns, prompting this headline in the Onion, Shaq terrified of Phoenix Suns after reading about supernovas. Okay, so he's, and there's this quote, people must realize that since I'm as big as 8 conventional stars, the risk of me going supernovas is that much greater. But this article is great for all kinds of supernova crazy quotes, where clearly the joke writers just went in and looked on Wikipedia about stuff. There's about 1 BCs and 2 Ls and everything in there. All right, but so we've tried to use these for cosmology, by the way, and you know, you can do something. You can do a proof of concept, but they're not very good, right? The scatter is 0.26 magnitudes because the plateau of these supernovae gives you a fairly constant magnitude if you correct for them to be observed at a certain day with certain colors and so on. So this is like the early days of type 1As, but they're always going to be a little worse. But the good thing is they have different systematics. So, you know, eventually once we get something like LSST and there's tons of these kinds of transients, you'll be able to do something and just to test systematics in type 1As. Okay, so what we really want here, these type 1As, like I said, thermonuclear explosion of the carbon-oxygen white dwarf in a binary. They're bright and standard. We think they explode when they get near the Chandrasekhar mass. But they're not, of course, not perfectly standard. They are, they have different brightnesses, but the brightness is correlated with the width of the light curve, so that the dimmer ones have a less wide light curve and the brighter ones have a wider one, and you can standardize them. We call this the stretch, how wide the light curve is. So our project is imaging a 1-square-degree field, so something of this size, 2 of those on any given night, 4 total during the year, every 4 days, GRIZ, and we discover supernovae and then follow them at the same time because it's a rolling search. We're always looking at the same part of the sky, and we get beautiful light curves like this in 4 colors. And we've got about 2,000 supernova candidates in almost 5 years, about almost 400 type 1As with spectra. To put it in perspective, in 2003, before we started, there were 2,700 supernovae known in the last 1,000 years, and that includes everything with any kind of data. You know, maybe 50 had data as good as this. So we're really making a huge data set of 1As and all kinds of transients.
Is the stretch actually kind of colored?
Yes, and I'll get to that in 1 second. I may not go into it in complete detail, but make me come back to that if I don't. spectra. We then send these to all of the world's largest 8 to 10 meters, to get a spectra that looks something like that. That's, you can't see it very well there, but we want to see what the type is and get the redshift. So we have about 8 nights a year on Keck, 120 hours a year on Gemini, same thing on VLT, and a few nights a year on Magellan. Sometimes we try to go back and get the host redshift if we missed it. So we had about 10% of the time on CFHT, which is a 4 meter for imaging, and then we actually end up with a few percent of the time on these 8 to 10 meters to do the spectra. So the community has been very good to us in committing a large amount of resources to match the amount of resources that we put in with CFHT, which is what really makes this a success. We then take our redshift distribution. It's just here's what it is. The things in darker gray are the things that are confirmed type 1As. The things in lighter gray are consistent with being a type 1A from the spectrum, but maybe they have noisier spectra, or they could also be consistent with a 1C or something like that. So we go up to about redshift 1, and then we're less complete. So here's roughly how it works. Here's a 1-degree field. Okay. This is stacked up over multiple nights, but we're going pretty deep. You can see as we start to zoom in, all of these little things are galaxies, of course, except for the things with diffraction spikes, which are stars. So most of these things are galaxies. And as we zoom in on this one case right here, okay, so you can see there's a supernova. Okay, so this time scale here is something like 3 weeks to rise in the rest frame. For us, maybe it's 5 weeks or so. And then it fades again. Okay. So this is basically what we measure is in multiple filters. This is GR and I here. The thing brightening and fading, like I said, over a course of maybe a couple of months. And then what we measure is the peak brightness, the color, and the width of the light curve, the stretch. So we then, you know, get the distance modulus by comparing the magnitude to the absolute magnitude, but you can normalize that away. You don't really need to know that. We have some parameter times the stretch, times the width of the light curve, and then some parameter times the color that does the correction for each one of these pieces. Sorry? The halo of the star. No, in that case, it's not a problem. As long as, you know, you're observing in the same sort of orientation and so on, if the reflection happens in the same spot and everything, when you do the subtraction, it can go away. And in for most of our cases, you know, things are uncontaminated by things like that. Occasionally you'll get a diffraction spike or something that will, you know, contaminate a thing, and we just basically mask out those areas and they're effectively not used. In that case, it's not really a problem. Okay, so now, why do we need all of those colors? Well, one thing is that we have to do a K correction. So we're observing in GRIZ, so these filters right here, which these filters. Okay, but the supernova is you know, the low redshift data is in something like UB and V, and in the rest frame of the, so here's the supernova spectral energy distribution, okay, and here are the rest frame filters, okay, and then as it goes up in redshift, it will start matching up with each one of these different observed filters. So at a certain redshift, we may want to convert R to B band and so on. So I'll just let this run, and you can see that as you go up in redshift, it matches up with different filters. And then so we can get not only the rest frame B band, which is what we want for cosmology, but we then get colors as well over a wide redshift range. If you don't have all of those colors, you're only limited to a very narrow redshift range, and you can't get good color information on the supernovae. So we then have to do this transformation, we needed to know the what the spectra of an average type 1A supernova look like, and we've produced the state-of-the-art ones of those through this program with Richard Ellis, and then Eric Casal, a grad student at Victoria, produced our K corrections.
How many standard 1A
templates are? How many of these kinds of the standard ones? There was one done by Peter Nugent a long time ago, but he just sort of threw things together. Admittedly, you know, he will say that he did not do an incredibly thorough job of that. So that's why we wanted to produce a new one. Eric produced this new one, and then very recently, you know, the other teams have their own version that they've made, although we put ours, made ours public so that other people can use it as well, and other people have done something like that. Basically, there's like two or something, not very many. Okay, so why you have to correct for color and how should you do it? This is probably the most important thing in 1A cosmology right now. Okay, so this on this axis is some measure of color. This C is a linear combination of U minus B and B minus V depending on the redshift. Okay, but just think of this as color. You know, redder this way, bluer this way. Okay, and on the left-hand side, it's residual from the Hubble diagram if you don't make the color correction. So in other words, this is your color relation. These are different light curve fitters. So SALT is the one our French colleagues came up with. Okay, it stands for Supernova Adaptive Light Curve, Spectral Adaptive Light Curve Technique. SIFTO is a brand of Canadian table salt, and so we named ours SIFTO. Okay, but here is if you fit this color relation, this is the solid line in every case here. MLCS is what some other people use, and this dashed line is the Milky Way dust if you just enforce Milky Way dust, so like R sub D of 3.1. Okay. So you can see the data. Oh, well, one other thing just to point out is that, you know, they use a prior because of the way that they do these things, because they don't have as much color information, and that, you know, sort of screws up your analysis a little bit, and that's not really what you should be doing. You know, in our opinion, you should use all the data. But so they found this result that was that there was this thing called Hubble bubble. They found the difference in H-naught below 7,400 kilometers a second, that basically the distant supernovae were too faint. Okay, but so they said, well, maybe this is a local void in the mass density or something. They said it was a 6% error on W, but as it turns out, it had to do with the way that they were enforcing this Milky Way dust correction. But if you actually fit for it, you don't find that. So here's the significance of the Hubble bubble. If you just say that it's Milky Way dust, you see that there is the Hubble bubble at a significance of that's like 3 sigma. Here's 1 sigma. But if you actually fit the data, you get that there is no significant Hubble bubble. So basically that kind of systematic in the cosmology is sort of double counting your reddening systematic. And so we don't think there is a Hubble bubble. Okay, but I didn't quite answer your question. The problem here is that redder supernovae are also intrinsically fainter. And so there's a degeneracy between the intrinsic supernova color and the reddening. So that's the biggest issue here, is it's arguments about how to make that correction. So we sort of throw them all together and make this empirical correction, whereas other people try to separate it, or they have in the past tried to separate it. I'm not sure what they're going to do now. The problem is if you can't truly separate it, then you can make these kinds of mistakes if you're not exactly right about separating it.
But I mean, how comfortable are you saying that the R sub is different?
Well,
is that what you're saying?
Not. That's why it's called beta and not R sub V. Okay, because it's sort of a mixture. Okay, but it could be. It's mostly dominated by dust. But since it's a mixture, it's not necessarily. We're not totally saying that we're not saying absolutely surely the dust is different around type 1A supernovae. Although when people have studied it using more sophisticated techniques like infrared, local supernovae, where you can go way out into the infrared, get a bunch of data on one particular supernova, they found values like this, very low values of R sub B. So that's certainly, I mean, obviously much work needs to be done in that case, but that's the way things are going, I think. Okay, so now, putting all that together, we can produce a Hubble diagram. Now, this is our third year analysis, so it's like SNLS 3 or whatever, with the WMAP naming convention. Okay, but it's 250 supernovae. It's independent analysis from our first year result, which is out there. This isn't yet published. Different calibration route, different photometric methods, different light curve analysis tools, like I said, independent everything except for the low redshift data set compared to what is already published. But we find something very consistent. But one good thing is that we're actually improving the errors better than square root of n would suggest is possible, and that's because we're learning about them as standard candles, and we're actually improving them as standard candles. So with the same number of supernovae, you can effectively you can use them more effectively now, given that we know more.
And that the blue points are just your redshift bins?
Yeah, that's just the average in the bins.
So let me ask you a question. So if you threw out the data, took your lowest blue point at 0.2, and you just threw out the stuff to the left, all the red points.
Yeah.
I would presume you'd actually. I guess what I'm saying is, How nearby does everybody need to be in the news flow?
Yeah.
So my question is, you just threw out all the red points.
Yeah.
And you just took your data set and used the ones at 0.2 as your nearby sample.
Yeah.
Aren't you basically...
Well, okay. Well, the bins are just for display purposes. Okay, so it's not like that's what we're actually fitting.
No.
But they do have a big effect because you're really anchoring, you know, this kind of relation, and we're really doing effectively a relative comparison of these to these, right? And so if you do this, you're really not getting as much, you know, dynamic range on that comparison. Chris Pritchett figured out the rough answer, and it was something like you do a factor of 3 worse or something like that. Not quite sure how robust it is. Obviously, it depends on your exact assumptions and so on. But, you know, there is great motivation for getting a better lower redshift sample. We have thought about that, about just trying to use ours, as we might yet do that in the cosmology paper, just to see what it is. So, it's a good point, though. Okay, so here are our constraints on W. Now, when this is statistical only, okay, this is about a 6.5% measure, which is the best anybody's done so far. Here it's combined with the BAO results and WMAP3 results, okay, and okay, so basically it's instead of big rip or quintessence, this is, you know, consistent with the cosmological constant, as far as we can tell. Now, we can also ask, is the universe flat? That last graph assumed flatness, okay? We relax that assumption, do the calculation. The data set here is listed here, but includes the Reese data. And we find something that is consistent with flatness. Now, when Alex Conley ran this, when you do this, and he modified Cosmo MC to be able to do this with supernovae properly, because as it worked, it wasn't really correct, it ran for 6 days on 4 processors, and by the time it got done, it was obsolete because WMAP5 came out. So, okay, since that's like less than 6 days old, we don't have that result yet. But, you know, he's working on it. But basically, the universe is flat to within about 1%. Okay. Now, systematic errors. Okay, this is going to be the name of the game now, because there are all these things that can screw up your answer in a systematic way. There's the boring old experimental systematics, which are incredibly important, but not as fun to talk about, so I won't talk about them very much. There's contamination issues, how you do the K correction, things that like peculiar velocities, whether or not there's a Hubble bubble, weak lensing, how you treat dust, super important. I already mentioned that a little bit. But the more interesting things to me are things like, is the evolution and the properties, are there evolution in the properties of supernovae individually or in a population? Okay. And so the other thing I want to point out about this diagram is we publish papers on all of these things, or either they're in the works. So most, you know, everybody remembers the cosmology paper, but most of our papers are analyzing, you know, getting into the details of all of these systematic potential sources of systematic errors. So we'll talk about this population drift first. So one way to test this is to look at the host galaxies of the type 1a supernovae. So since we get all of this data, we can add U-band data to it. We get that in a non-time sequenced way. And then we can say, okay, get the photometry of the host galaxy and then fit galaxy models to the host galaxies and then group them into bins based on whether whether the models say that they're passive star forming or they have really rapid star formation. Okay, and then we'll just do this simple kind of thing, which is split the supernova rate into a component times the mass and a component times the star formation rate, which is something that Evan and Lars proposed. Okay, and when we do that, we see that basically the star formation rate is increasing as you go to these bursty, or the more star formation you have, the higher the supernova rate. Okay, so just to go over these axes, so the supernova rate per unit stellar mass in a galaxy, okay, versus the specific star formation rate, which is the star formation rate per stellar mass. Okay, and we've got over here in ellipticals, you know, there's the star formation rate is basically zero. That's why it's shaded. And then as you go up, you get in these star forming regions, you get higher supernova rate. Now, that means that there's a component of supernovae that track a young population. So this old idea that supernovae are from elliptical galaxies and white dwarfs that are really old is not right. Most of them come from star forming regions. Okay. So, and the other crazy thing about it is that the population affects the luminosity. So the ones in the star-forming hosts have on average a higher stretch than the ones in the passive hosts. So the distribution, the histogram here is, well, basically the data. And then the Gaussians are fit to it for the next graph. Okay, so the brighter ones are in the star formers. Okay, and then if we look at what happens versus redshift, well, we know that the star formation increases with redshift. Okay, so it's a complicated diagram, but basically, as redshift increases, there's a supernova rate that's these lines. So don't even worry about this one. That's a Minucci model. It's a different model. But let's just stick to this A plus B model. S06 is Sullivan 06, the paper that we started doing something like this. Okay, this is the component that matches star formation. So this is taking the Hopkinson-Beacom star formation rate and then applying our A and B values that I was talking about when we parameterized them earlier. We determined these constants, A and B, a component times the mass and a component times star formation rate. So here's what these supernovae should do. Here's what the older supernovae should do with redshift. And so a couple of things are worth noting is, one is that, well, since they have different distributions, you might think that the mix will change with time and the distribution of supernova properties will change with time. Another thing is that if you can measure the rates of these separately, you can determine something about the progenitors of each component. Okay, and we're trying to do that. We're not finished yet, but we'll see how that goes. But taking the first part, here are these Gaussians scaled by, in the previous diagram, we're just going to scale. Here's the Gaussian fit to the data, okay, and then we're going to scale it by how much there should be versus redshift according to this model.
You should measure those separately.
Yeah.
You're separating them based on
what? Well, we take the host galaxy properties, right? So we take the host photometry, and then we say
stretch.
Right, and then, well, it just happens that they have different stretches. So
okay,
yeah.
I was wondering,
yeah,
if
sure.
You're distinguishing based on that.
Yeah. And then we scale at each redshift, okay, like how much of the prompt component are the ones that happen with star formation and delayed are the ones that take longer. So we scale each of those components, okay, with redshift based on this last figure there. And so this is not a fit to this data in the background. In the background, it's data. This is the prediction from this model, okay, for measuring A and B from the host galaxies and then saying when we compare it to cosmic star formation, what do we expect the difference to be? And we see this Gaussian set, it should shift as you go to higher redshift. Okay, so this is local. This is redshift 1.1 or so. And the data is what we see, okay, from these different supernova populations, SNLS, low redshift, and the Ries high redshift data. And we do see that these lines here are the average of the data, that it does increase. So the average supernova is 12% brighter at a redshift greater than 1 compared to today. Okay, but you know, people, and when you initially tell them that, they think, oh, you know, forget supernovae then. But if the stretch correction works well, you don't have to worry about this because you're just changing the mix, and as long as you can calibrate them, then it's okay. So we've done this by splitting the supernovae into, this is a composite light curve of a bunch of different type 1As all put on the same diagram, normalized. We did it separately in passive galaxies and active galaxies, and okay, it's a little bit noisy because there's some really high redshift data in here, but you can see that they look about the same. Okay, so that's one test. And then another thing is we just do the cosmology separately for galaxies in star-forming regions and in the passive galaxies, with elliptical galaxies, and we compute these parameters separately, alpha, beta, etc. I'll have a more graphical representation of that in a second. But basically, there's not a lot of difference in the W that comes out. It's quite consistent. As you see, the problem is the low number of supernovae and passive galaxies at low redshift. But there's some small evidence for decreased scatter. The RMS scatter is 0.13 versus 0.16. So, you know, as you might expect, these have less dust. Maybe they're more well-behaved, but there are fewer of them. So with large samples, you can think about doing cosmology only with ones in ellipticals and things like that to get around your dust problem. Okay, so...
Ben, let me ask you, I haven't seen this problem before. So it looks to me like you actually have an A plus B ratio in redshift 28. You actually know how many are coming from passive and some
of yes, but to actually do it correctly... You need to, you know, of course, figure out what your selection effects are and everything else like that, right? So, yeah, to very rough approximation of the string.
Before they come back to 12% at C1, what is the error of the 12% that you're
estimating? It's about, let's see, it's quoted in my paper, but it's about 3% or something like that. It's a little bit more than a 3 sigma result.
Right, but you feel this obviously statistically significant.
Yeah.
And how much of the stretch factor is empirical versus...
Yeah, stretch is completely empirical. So it's just, here's what the light curve is, here's how much you stretch a template light curve to match it. That's what it is. So in fact, the theory of it was not known before, you know, people did it, and then they, you know, afterwards went back and said, well, what's the theory of this? And so. Okay. Now, so we split the cosmology all kinds of different ways, okay? Changing different samples, split low stretch and high stretch supernovae, the different fields. Classification index is what I think about the spectrum. So that's the ones that are absolutely certain 1As versus the ones that are probable 1As. And then HT is Hubble type, so versus different galaxies and stuff. And so, okay, don't try to look at every number in this table, but the basic thing is that, you know, things are consistent. There's no real showstoppers. To look at it a little bit better graphically, when split by galaxy type, the alpha and beta determined separately for the elliptical and spiral populations are consistent. Now, for the stretch, it's a little bit different. The low stretch supernovae and the high stretch supernovae, there's some evidence that beta, for example, is different in the two populations, which gets back to this question about mixing. How much mixing is there? I mean, how much, you know, this is more likely to be more dust and this is more likely to be more intrinsic supernova. So, it's not clear. This is you know, approximately consistent. There may be something like a 1.5 sigma difference, but this is very preliminary, and our French colleagues have not signed off on this particular analysis. They do their analysis a little bit differently.
Could
so.
The sign rise?
Yeah.
Reddening?
Yeah.
Okay. Because I was worried that it could be...
Yeah. Higher beta is, you know, reddening is B of 4. Okay. So, you know, it goes in the right direction. Okay, so now let's talk about evolution of intrinsic type 1A properties. Are those different? Well, on a case-by-case basis, on that last thing was ensemble, but it'd be more worrying if we find examples where they're, you know, really exotic supernovae at high redshift. Okay, so we all know the Chandrasekhar limit, right? Theoretically, the limit to a white dwarf star is 1.4 solar masses. That's electron degeneracy pressure. You can't pack electrons any tighter. And supernovae explode right before they reach this limit. So in some ways, you know, this is not the reason supernovae are empirically known to be standard, but this gives us a nice warm fuzzy feeling that, hey, they all blow up at the same mass, so that's why they're all standard. Okay, but maybe not quite so fast. So we have this paper in Nature saying that we found a case that where that's not the case. Okay, so got a lot of press, and here's one example of, you know, the supernova blowing up, and here's these grid lines of space-time being all, you know, our cosmology is all screwed up, and then, you know, it says in there, shakes the expanding universe theory or whatever. Of course it doesn't, but my favorite bit of press was somehow this ended up in ESPN.com. Okay, so like this thing is talking about, like, you know, football and cheerleaders, and I like this quote: "They're gorgeous, but why are they mythic?" You know, I haven't even read the whole rest of the article. I have no idea what that's talking about. But then I don't know why, suddenly, you know, the Chandrasekhar limit in the middle of the sports page, and then, you know, Chandrasekhar himself, and, you know, he thought there was a limit to the destructive power of nature, but it looks like he was wrong. You know, whatever. So, okay, whatever. But so it doesn't make me want to go back to all the jocks I knew in high school and say, you know, you'll never be on ESPN, but I will be one day. But anyway. Okay, so how do we figure this out? Well, there's two routes. You get 1As have energy from the kinetic energy from the explosion, and that happens when fusion just sort of rips through the star and unbinds it. Okay, and so you get that kinetic energy from the explosion. Okay, carbon and oxygen burn to intermediate mass elements, and the burning continues up to iron peak elements in the most dense part. So the more thoroughly this happens, the more energy you get. Okay, so you burn way up to nickel, then you're going to have a whole lot of energy to really unbind that star. Okay, so the high velocities, in theory, more nickel, you should have higher velocity. Okay, light curve energy is what we see. Like when I showed you the picture of the supernova getting brighter, that was not the explosion energy. That happens right away. That was the nickel decay. Okay, that takes about 3 weeks to reach a peak. So that's nickel 56 decaying to cobalt 56 decaying to iron 56. Okay, so if you totaled up a supernova, if you could convert it to nickels, it, one supernova is about 12 nonillion dollars, okay? Or that's about 12 nonillion Canadian, you know, that used to be funny because there was a exchange rate, but now it's par because of the, you know, wonderful financial situation that the U.S. is in. Okay, but now, here's how, okay, so what we do is we basically work backwards from the luminosity and figure out how much nickel was there. Okay, so, you know, you can read the physics if you really want to, or look in the paper for a more complete version, but the bottom line is that this is most normal supernovae, the lower chipset, that's easy to do this for. And here's our crazy example up here, okay, very high luminosity, very high implied nickel mass, it's about 1.3 solar masses. Now, if you say that 40% of the white dwarf has to be non-nickel, non-nickel 56, which is the typical case, then you get something like, from this simple estimate, a 2 solar mass white dwarf. Okay. Now, if you go and calculate it the other direction, from the which is going to be harder, well, first let's just look at the properties of this thing to make sure it's not like I'm just totally smoking crack. It is a type 1A, okay, so it's got your silicon and sulfur, that's the defining characteristics, and it looks like 94D, which is, here's a low redshift, you know, canonical example, looks very similar, but there are some differences. Okay, now this is just a theoretical spectrum so that you can identify the features. There's very little calcium compared to silicon and sulfur, and nobody knows why that is. That doesn't really fit in. I don't have an answer. It's low velocity instead of high velocity. Okay, which is very puzzling. Remember I said, if it has all of this nickel, it should have a very high kinetic energy, but it doesn't. And there's this feature here that we could not find another explanation for. It could be carbon, unburned material from the explosion. We're not completely sure about that, but you know, it sort of matches. There's predicted to be a carbon line there now. Another, okay, so now to really do that calculation about the kinetic energy, well, not to, you know, to do it in a fairly simple-minded way, if you take normal supernovae, okay, this is the amount of nickel you get, and this is the velocity, so these are very simple models, basically done like this, okay, that the nuclear energy minus the binding energy, so the energy you get in the explosion minus the binding energy gives you the kinetic energy, okay, so you can calculate it very simply. By just saying, here's the fraction of unburned carbon. If you don't burn the whole star, you don't get as much energy. So you go down this in these models. And the more of the star you burn, you know, the longer these lines can get because you can put more into nickel. And in cases, you know, basically these match Chandrasekhar. These are all Chandrasekhar mass models. They match normal data that you would ever see. Here's our crazy supernova over here. Instead of being with this much nickel, you know, being out here, instead, it's very low. It's one of the lowest supernova velocities ever seen. Now, if you then allow super Chandrasekhar mass models, basically the increased binding energy means that you can get to lower velocities, and it's just sort of an independent argument. You get about 2 solar masses again. Okay, now, somebody needs to do this really well with a full model and so on, and not just in a very simple way as I've done it. So when I was at KITP, I made a bet with Stan Woosley, an expensive bottle of wine, over whether or not he could fit all of this into a Chandra body. And I just, you know, emailed him like a couple of days ago, and he said, they've tried a bunch of stuff in the last year or so. They don't have an answer. They haven't been able to make anything work, but they're also not ready to concede. So, okay. But it's stimulating a lot of interesting ideas from Dan Kaysen, who's working with him on exotic things to do to try, you know, try to test every way of organizing a white dwarf to be able to do it in under a Chandra mass. Okay, so, well, what does this tell us about the progenitors of type 1A supernovae? Well, okay. Everybody agrees up to here what happens, okay? You basically get a white dwarf and another star, okay? But then what happens after this? Well, the standard picture that I showed you in the introduction is that you get accretion onto a white dwarf and it explodes. But an alternate route is that you could get another white dwarf and then they could merge and make a type 1A supernova. Okay, so how do we explain this very high mass, if that's what it is? Well, the standard way is to have this white dwarf be rotating very quickly and you can increase the Chandrasekhar mass. Now, Lars and some other people say if you've got magnetic fields, you can't get the differential rotation that's required, and in fact, you can't get much above the Chandrasekhar mass. which kind of leaves us with the alternative of having two white dwarfs that merge. Now, that is still not very well calculated, but I'm hoping now that there's extra reason to do it, people will get a better idea of if that is the viable route. But it looks to me like that's what we're more or less left with. Now, there's another interesting piece of evidence, and that is that this thing was in this tiny little, like a few times the size of the LMC satellite galaxy to this bigger galaxy. So this thing that you can hardly see on this image. Now, the host age from doing this model fits and so on, again, to the galaxy, is something like 0.7 gigayears old. Of course, that's just assuming a constant star formation rate and so on, which is ridiculous, but the key thing is it's blue, it's young, okay. Very young, probably. Now, but there's new evidence for Superchandra, and let's see how that fits into this story, okay. First, there's this picture that I dug up. I made the picture, whatever. But then there's other supernova that have been recently discovered. Last time I gave this talk, that was just it. It was the Superchandra picture, or one of the previous times. But now there's Hicken et al., this result, that basically says 2006 GZ, here is their answer. Now, again, Redding correction, highly uncertain, but 1.2 solar masses or one solar mass, depending on how you make this correction. Okay, here's our answer for ours, which, by the way, we assume no reddening. So, if there is reddening, that will go even higher. So they used a different method for calculating the mass, but, they get something that's pushing the limits. Okay, but then there are other similarities. Okay, so just to remind you, these are maximum light spectra. This is ours. Okay, it has another name as well, but it's the same supernova. Then here's theirs. Okay, looking at the same phase, there are similarities. You see this low velocity features here, where you can resolve these two features in a normal supernova. You can't. So this is probing at maximum light. It's probing the interior of the star. Because remember, as the supernova expands, you're seeing deeper and deeper into it. Okay, so we only had a spectrum at maximum light of ours, but and there is the same feature here, which we identified as carbon, and they see it too. Okay. Now, but the great thing is they have early time spectra. Okay, so that's when you're seeing the outer layers of the star. And the really cool thing is that it's slow all the way through. It's slow all the way back. So it's not like this thing just slowed down, lately. We're able to say something about the velocity evolution of the features. And we can also see that at early times, there was really solid evidence for carbon in this case. This doesn't come out very well in this projection, but basically here, here, and over here, there is real solid evidence for carbon.
Yeah, I didn't realize they had minus 14 days, and
yeah.
They got very lucky.
Yeah. This was CFA, I guess. I'm not sure exactly how they did it, but yeah. But, since it's the CFA group, I assume that's how they did it. But, yeah. So, anyway, in the outer layers, there is clearly evidence, if these two things are related, and it looks like they are, for unburned stuff. Okay, so this explosion was not as efficient as it could have been. Okay, then there's this 2007 IF, which was discovered by the Supernova Factory. Again, it's very bright, magnitude about minus 20, which is comparable to ours. It's in a faint host, about minus 14. Okay.
What's that? Discovered by Rotzi 3.
Oh, sir, you're right. Rotzi 3 and Supernova Factory. I say Supernova Factory in my head only because that's who gave me the spectrum and stuff, so I just mentally associated it incorrectly. Good point. At least I had it right in the caption. All right, so anyway, super faint host, which they could not see except for by adding up a whole bunch of stuff. Okay. And again, low velocity, carbon, little calcium compared to silicon. Oh, wait, I didn't have the last thing. Okay, so all of these four sort of signatures we see, and now this is the third example. Okay, so this is shaping up to be something like a new class of supernovae, if everybody's right about this. All of these characteristics they all seem to have. I did not mention that they all seem to be in these sort of tiny little hosts or young population. Now, the Hicken et al. One is not necessarily, it's more like in a spiral, but on the outskirts in a spiral arm, so consistent with that, but we're not really sure about it. Okay, now, what does it tell us about? Again, the model pictures here. For the single degenerate model, as we said, it may be impossible to go beyond the change of Schrödinger mass. there are other predictions for the model, like you should see hydrogen at some point. Nobody's ever seen that in a normal type 1A supernova. If it was this rapid rotation picture, you might expect to see just field-wide dwarfs just really rotating like crazy, but that's not usually seen. And the same thing as you might see just field-wide dwarfs with something like 1.6 solar masses or something, which is not usually seen. I like this merger picture better in the sense that it predicts excess carbon as these things are merging together, which we do see in these explosions. Now, there's a natural prediction that you would see these brighter ones in a younger population. Because in the youngest population, you have the most massive white dwarfs, because the massive stars turn off quickly, leave you with massive white dwarfs. When those merge, in a young population, you could have to have things above the Chandrasekhar mass when they merge. Okay? Whereas in an older population, you can go get dimmer ones. And whether or not there's slow velocity evolution in this picture, Peter Hoflick has calculated some very simple-minded models saying if you have a big puffy layer of carbon and oxygen that you might get in the later stages as these merge, that could slow these things down and give velocity. But people need to really verify that with very extensive calculations. Then the question becomes, well, if these are mergers, then can this explain all supernovae? And that's really the sort of question of the moment. Nobody knows exactly. But there's a lot of research going on. Okay, so just to quickly sum up the systematic error story, I only talked about a couple of like the most fun cases to me, but maybe I'll skip this because it's boring. But it's really important, but it's not that fun to talk about. Okay, but I'll just give you the bottom line, which is sort of not how we do the systematics. Please ask me if you care. But in what we think are the most important systematics for supernovae. Okay, and this is basically W error, and then this is if you add the statistical plus any one of these things. Now, then if you sort of subtract it in quadrature, you can work out how much effect that is. But that's basically this pi thing over here. So the real bottom line is that the largest errors are the things that have to do with the external zero points, putting things on the Vega system. So basically trying to work out, what was Landolt doing, what were his filter functions, and so on back in the days before precision cosmology. That's our biggest problem. Okay, so as new data sets come online, we'll be able to, people think of this, they use the words like systematic wall, like, there's no point in doing supernovae anymore because we're hitting the limit of systematics, so why get more statistics? Well, in actuality, the systematics are about 7%, so about the same as our statistics, but will drop as we, and some of these things like color relations are kind of like a statistical error because as you get more supernovae, you can measure that better. Okay, so then as you go to, say, the Sloan system, you can get rid of a lot of these. So, and in every case, we've been also working with improving our distance model. If you can use the higher velocity ones, you don't have to worry about peculiar velocities and so on. So there's great room, in fact, more room for rapid improvement on the systematics than there is on the regular type 1As. Okay. So now, for the first time, we are putting the systematic errors into our contours. Okay. Basically, the way we did this is that slide I skipped, but it's not important, but the bottom line is that we now find about 9.5 or so a percent error in W. Once you fold the systematics into the contours, the best fit goes down to about -1.07, but still consistent with the cosmological constant. So now this error is statistical plus systematic all folded into one.
How do you do that folding?
Okay, maybe I'll have to actually go back to this boring slide. But it's essentially that we follow like all these kind of correlations with each supernova. So for things like magnitude, stretch, color, we keep track of the covariance between all the supernovae. So let's say you know an effect that changes the magnitude, like some zero point thing. You do that for all your supernovae, okay, and then you see how much it changes the magnitude, how much it changes all of these things with a correlation matrix like this. This is for 300 by 300, one line for each supernova, and then there's six of these for each of these kinds of pairs for whatever systematic you want to analyze, and then you do all this up, and you basically then can say, okay, I changed this one thing, and I see how it changes the contours, and so on, and you fold each subsequent thing into the contours. It's pretty tedious. It's a little more complicated than that, but we can talk more offline if you're interested. Now we've got this answer. So now we're saying with all the systematics, all these uncertainties, supernovae are still giving us a pretty good answer. Better than we thought we'd actually be able to when we started the survey. Okay, so answers for now. Dark energy is consistent with the cosmological constant to within about 10%. If it's a cosmological constant, it's a property of the vacuum, meaning that as you expand some piece of the universe, the dark energy is not diluting. Okay, matter is, but dark energy is not, which is crazy stuff. But that's what it says. Okay, it's something like 10 to the minus 26 kilograms per meter cubed. So in every cubic meter of space, so that's like a few hydrogen atoms. So not much in any one spot, but over long distances, it really adds up. Okay, why is the dark energy similar to the omega matter? We don't know. That's still just going to have to remain a mystery if it's a cosmological constant. Okay. You know, blah, 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 we'll do better in the future. I'm going to skip ahead to some more science just very quickly to say that we have like 17 papers submitted or so, like I said, most on the physics and cool stuff about supernovae, a few on cosmology and other things like that. And then we have about five more or so that are in draft form that we're ready to submit pretty soon. So it's been remarkably scientifically productive. I probably don't really have time to go into some of these other things, but maybe let me just skip to one or two examples of, first of all, we're doing rates with internally rates, rate evolution with only our data, which is the red points here. In the past, people have added together, you know, disparate data sets and so on, but now we're able to see this rising star formation, supernova rate that matches star formation rate from our data. Don't believe these numbers because this is not really the way you want to measure A and B. This is just like saying, you know, doing it from this diagram, which is not really the right way to do it. But you get, like I said, you can then get independent rates once we split these up, which we'll do very momentarily. We'll be able to get information about the progenitors. Okay.
Is that all your data now or not?
Yes. This is with, well, the third year data set. We still have two more years to add to it. That, yeah, everything, all the analyses so far are up to the third year data set. Okay, and like I said, this is, you know, the prompt component, the delayed component. Okay, we're comparing low redshift and high redshift supernovae in the ultraviolet, and ironically, we have much better data at high redshift because things are redshifted into the optical. The red lines here, the low redshift data, there's only two examples of supernovae we could compare to our great high redshift data. Okay, we have a Keck proposal to try to test that. Okay, we'll just skip metallicity because it's too complicated to explain really quickly. We're trying to do corrections to the Hubble diagram using spectroscopic features rather than reddening or stretch or anything. So if you don't believe any of that empirical stuff, we'll throw a new empirical method at you, and it works almost as well. Okay, so that's encouraging. Hypernovae, we've got some of those, and you know they've got pretty cool spectra like hers. Doesn't really come out very well on this, but trust me, they're cool. AGN, we've got tons of them in our data. We're comparing optically selected AGN versus X-ray selected AGN, for example. Now here's an example that is crazy to me. This thing, I don't know what it is, but there's some wiggles that look supernova-ish. Okay, here's the reference image. So before there was anything, there's a stellar-ish looking thing. Could be an unresolved galaxy, could be a star. Here's it at peak, here's the subtraction. Okay, and here's two other transients that are unknown from the Supernova Cosmology Project. And, well, the Supernova Cosmology Project also. Vaguely similar, it's very hard to tell. These are, we don't know the redshift of any of them because in this case it's too faint to get a redshift so far. In the other cases there was no thing there. And the light curve, this is not supposed to be a fit. This is just to compare to a 1A to show you that it's very different. The light curve takes about 80 days to rise and fall, which is sort of odd. Yeah, so anyway, we don't know what it is. Trying to work it out. We need to really get a redshift to do it, but if you got any ideas, let us know. Okay, so that's about it. If you want to ask questions about some of the other science I skipped or any other thing, I'll just leave you with these three thoughts. That type 1As make excellent standard candles, and they're only the only real direct probe of dark energy that we can use right now. It's consistent with the cosmological constant to the best of anybody's ability to do, which is 6.5%. Supernovae care about their environment, and they evolve in their average properties with time, but we think we can correct for that and certainly test it. And then there's a class of supernovae that are luminous, have low expansion velocities, unburned carbon, occur in a young population. We don't know that this is leaving off whether or not they're superchandra, but you know, it looks to me like it's more likely that those result from mergers than from anything else. So that's it. Oh, there's a couple up here, too. But,
yeah. Great talk. I want to come back to this issue of higher Z having higher luminosity, basically.
Just show the histogram.
I think
it would help.
Yeah.
It's just there's two distributions and they're different.
Yeah, the question is, what does that really mean in terms of interpretation? I guess your conclusion is it doesn't really change interpretation.
How do you mean the last part?
Well, just based on what you're telling me, and otherwise you would have told me that the errors are larger.
I mean, we think that there is, you should definitely be aware of this effect. Look out for it, but it seems to, instead of the intrinsic luminosity changing, the real worry is more that the environments may change in the sense that your colors will be affected and your reddening, you know, whatever your color correction is due to, that may change with redshift. Now, we do simulate this in the sense that we say, what if beta evolves with redshift and so on, this reddening correction, and we, you know, make sure that we try to include that in our systematics. Now, the systematics I showed right there are not, do not include that effect. This is because we're at the final stages of agreeing on that with our French collaborators. But, you know, the final answer will have that factored in. But that's, to me, the more important effect than if the stretch we know we can handle, that's dead simple. It's this color that's spooky.
Yeah, so in view of this new service, like, Snap or whatever it's called now. Mm-hmm. So is the infrared data just going to give us higher redshift supernovae, or is it going to help us with a low redshift signal?
Well, for Snap's particular design, so I'm on the Type 1A working group for Snap, but I'm not really a direct participant. But they, as it is, they sort of have all their filters sort of glued down to their CCDs, and then they sort of drift across the field, and then you will get infrared and optical at the same time when you're sort of piling together a field. So you'll get all of the data. So yes, you can do some of these tests for the lower redshift data.
What is it going to tell us that we don't know today?
Well, if you can get just great infrared data, and now people are trying to do this at lower redshift with the Carnegie Supernova Program. We've been working with them, giving them our supernovae, and then they've been going out and getting infrared data on Magellan. The reddening law, of course, as you change the reddening law, it really, you know, you see the effect all through the infrared colors. And so by measuring that, you can basically say, okay, this here's what the actual reddening, you can reconstruct the reddening law, basically, and you can say, here's what it is. So that, I mean, there is a couple of things that we must do now. One is low redshift data set, right? Two is figuring out stuff and doing infrared observations of type 1A. Three is just building giant samples so that we can split things up by anything we think of. You know, we want to do this Hubble diagram by metallicity. We can do that. You know, we want to do it by tiny galaxies or by anything you can conceive of. So.
So I was going to ask, is there any difference the abundance where the of the star that evolves into the white dwarf, if it's high or low, does that affect the eventual supernova properties?
So like say metallicity?
Would the abundance of the origin of the white dwarf have any effect on, for instance, the stretch parameter?
Well, I'm so happy that you asked that question, because I've just written a paper on that. Okay, so it's which one is it? Here we go. All right. Now I could give a whole talk on this subject, but I think here's the one slide summary, which is basically, okay, now we get nickel mass from the light curve. Okay, that's the left-hand axis. And then there's this other horrible permutation to get the bottom axis, which is we take the photometry, fit the galaxy models, determine something about the mass of the galaxy from the model, and then we use this Tremont relationship which relates mass of the galaxy to the metallicity. This is gas-phase metallicity. This is, you know, basically because larger galaxies have larger potential wells, they retain the metals, etc. Okay, so now mass is on the top, metallicity is on the bottom here. Okay. Basically, there's a huge amount of scatter, so right away you see that, okay, this is a prediction from Timmis Brown and Truran, 03, which says that as you go up towards environments where you have higher progenitor metallicity, you'll get more neutrons, basically, and the higher neutronization means you can get more nickel-58, which is stable compared to nickel-56, which decays and makes a beautiful supernova. Okay, so that this should go down as you reach these larger galaxies. Okay, now, but if we average up the data, we can see that, yes, they do follow this trend, and if you compare it to, say, a straight line and stuff like that, there is some evidence that the chi-squared is better for this model. But they said it was something like a 25% effect, because out here it turns way over, but the supernova hosts happen to be over here. So it's not, maybe it's as much as 10%, but we're not really sure.
But the variation of any mass
is dominated by things that are probably not related to this effect. So, like I said, as much as 10%, could be less.
So I'm still picking this, trying to come to terms with the revenue business.
Sure.
How do you make of the fact that the revenue law for the supernova doesn't seem to be the same as what we see in the galaxy?
Yeah.
And what are the typical revenue corrections that you end up making?
Right. So for the vast majority of supernovae, the reddening correction is very small. What we're doing...
Doesn't that bother you?
Well, not for... This has always been the case for type 1A. So this is... we are not finding anything new there.
It doesn't bother
you. Yeah, well, okay.
So nobody knows exactly, I cannot answer the question. Maybe a tiny bit. I want to know a little bit better why that is. Now, if somehow everybody is totally wrong and all supernovae are, somehow extincted, what really matters is the low redshift set compared to the high redshift set, because you're really doing a differential comparison. And that's where you run into problems. Like this Hubble bubble thing was that comparison. That was the problem. So, hey, it's a real trap. Sorry, what was the first part of the question was...
So why is... Is there any speculation about the reddening law should be different?
Yes, there is speculation. Lifan Wang has written a paper that says that it may have something to do with... there's a few different lines of speculation, but one is the just circumstellar environments around the supernova, that if grains of certain sizes are destroyed preferentially or not, okay. Or another is just the scattering in this sort of circumstellar environment, if it can do funny things that do not exactly, that sort of throw you off with the normal law and so on. I do not, I've not gone into great detail because I'm not convinced by any of the arguments that I've read so far. I would say the thing that everybody wants to be true is that there's one vector that has to do with supernova intrinsic brightness, that they're red and intrinsically, the dimmer ones, and there's another vector that has to do with dust, and we can separate the two cleanly and we go home, right? Now, that it's been very resistant to investigation. This Conley et al. Paper came out, or I had the graphs in hand while I was here last year, showed them around to various people, and they kind of scratched their heads and said, uh-oh. And then within a few months later in Aspen, everybody kind of got together and said, now what do we do about this? And everybody had, well, we'll be able to figure it out, and then hasn't been able to so far. So the only thing we need to do is do it empirically for now. Now, the other thing we do is we make a color cut in color space, so U minus B versus B minus C, and then we say, okay, we're only going to take this sort of locus of sort of normal supernovae. Anything that follow along the Redding vector that is very far away, we'll just cut them out of the sample. That cuts out about 10% or so, and then if we're really wrong, those won't hurt us as much. And those things sort of drive your, they can swing your relation and throw your relation off to get the wrong answer and so on. So, that's the one thing that we're doing about it right now. We want to do more, but it just takes a lot more data.
Are the bodies
Yeah, the 1As are reddened less than core collapse supernovae in general, which you might expect from, younger environments even in the core collapse supernovae.
But if you
travel on
some, there's
certain color,
where
does
it pass?
Yeah, let me see. I don't know if I have that plot. It's very obvious when you have these. Sure. No, it's a good question. It's just that I don't think I put that plot in here. It's probably in another talk, but I can show you later if you want. It's, here's some slides about it. It's basically that, let's see if it's this one. Okay, this is not quite the full answer, but this is a piece of it. So this is how the stretch and color versus residuals, whether you make the correction or not. So this is the final relation that we use to make the correction. Okay, so the black points are SMLS. Red points are non-SMLS, and the white points are the ones that are rejected. But they're not rejected in this space. This is the most important thing. They're rejected in color-color space. This one, that's not the full answer. In color-color space, it should not bias you against distance, say, because you're just saying what things are reddened. We know that dust reddens things. We'll get rid of them. Okay. But in here, you can see, okay, then what, you know, how does this relate to these relations? And so basically, yeah, the danger is that you can, if by including some of these outliers, you can sort of pull this line around because they have more leverage because they're farther away on the line, and then you will get all of these wrong, right? And so that's why we want to do that. We do the answer both ways, and, you know, we're just more comfortable with this way because we feel like it's safer.
All right. Let's see.